Well, what I want to talk about today is lawyers as insincere actors. I can't tell entirely how much what I'm about to say applies here in Germany, where lawyers play a somewhat different but overlapping role as they do in the United States. And I hope the discussion will in part be about how what I have to say is either relevant or irrelevant because of differences in the system here. But I don't believe it's entirely irrelevant, or I wouldn't have volunteered to give this presentation. I would have talked about something else. So the argument of my talk proceeds in a number of steps. The first step is that in communication with each other, sincerity is the norm. When we speak to each other, we assume that the speaker is sincere. When I talk to you about my views on issues of sincerity and lawyering and so on, those really are my views, and you believe them to be my views, and you're right. And similarly, when you speak to me, you will be telling me your views, and I will not only understand you as having intended to say the words that you said, but I will be understanding you as telling me those things because you believe them. That's really very normal, a very normal discourse assumption, which, of course, can be relaxed or challenged in certain situations, social situations. But it's really how we proceed, and if we didn't, we'd have to be on guard so much that it would be very difficult. Perhaps sometimes we're not on guard enough, but it's important to recognize that. The philosopher John Searle says that there are two levels of intent when we communicate with each other. One of them is that we intend to say the things we say, and the other is that we intend to portray them as our views. And the law actually absorbs those kinds of norms also. In contract law, for example, promises that sound like promises count as promises, even if you didn't mean it. So if I promise to do something for you that would ordinarily oblige me to do so under any jurisdiction's local contract law, I can't later say, well, I really didn't mean that. I was being insincere, so you can't hold me to it. You're assumed to be sincere, and if you're not, you're stuck with the obligation anyway, barring some very interesting kinds of circumstances. Same thing with threats. If somebody threatens you at an ATM machine and says, you'd better give me that money or I'm going to injure you with a knife or something like that, if they later say, well, I was just kidding, sorry you were so frightened, but I enjoy these kinds of things, you still will have, that person will have still threatened you because they said the things they wanted to say and you had every right to believe they meant it. That's really what my point is. Whether they meant it or not doesn't really matter. The law of fraud does not distinguish between lying and deception by means other than lying. If you say something knowing that it is likely to lead somebody to believe something to be true that you know to be false, in the relevant business context, you have defrauded them. So we assume sincerity in everyday interactions, and the law expects us to be sincere, and if we're not being sincere, it holds us to the consequences as if we were sincere. That is controversial at the margins, and there are environments where it's more or less true than others. We could talk about that later, but I think it's a pretty good general proposition. Now, secondly, lawyers have certain immunity from all of this. What's called the sincerity conditions in communication are suspended for lawyers in part. And that really is only a special case of the fact that sincerity conditions are suspended generally when you speak on somebody else's behalf. So actors don't have to be sincere. They just have to be good actors. Debaters can debate points and take positions in which they don't believe, and nobody really thinks less of them for it. They just think that they're skilled at their tasks and so on. the prototype military officers, as Searle uses the example of a military officer giving an order, it would be inappropriate to say to the officer, you know, I don't really want to obey that order because I don't think you sincerely believe that it's a good order. They'd say, what are you talking about? Nobody would even understand what that conversation's all about, and that's because the military officer is not obliged to be sincere in the way that the officer is ordering the subordinate to do something because he believes that that's the right thing to do. He's doing it because it's his job to give the order. And that's, again, speaking on behalf of an institution or a higher official still. So lawyers are really in a position where they can't help but be insincere, because their job is to help an individual put his or her best foot forward, because of the lawyer's superior knowledge in a world in which the client can't navigate. And there's a terrific quotation of this by the hearings to confirm our current Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, John Roberts. He was being challenged because of some of the statements that he made while he was a government lawyer that might have made him unsuitable to be the Chief Justice of the United States in the eyes of some. And he said, the positions that a lawyer presents on behalf of a client should not be ascribed to that lawyer as his personal beliefs or his personal positions. That is, you say what you have to say to help your client win. Now, he was saying that when he was in a policy position in the government, and we'll get back to that a little bit later, but I think that's a pretty typical understanding of what lawyers do. Now, we see this all the time with lawyers, and at least in the United States and to a lesser extent in Britain and Canada, where there's an adversarial system for criminal justice, lawyers can not only be insincere in representing criminal defendants, but they have to be. So it would be wrong for a lawyer to say, I can help my client be acquitted by challenging the veracity of a witness, but since I think the witness is telling the truth, I'm just going to sit down. That wouldn't be such a bad thing to do in terms of how well you can sleep at night, but it's simply unethical to do that. So there's not only a license to be insincere, but there's an obligation. And it goes even so far as many lawyers in the United States arguing that there's at least a right and probably an obligation to put on what's called a false defense, which means that it's without lying, without putting on perjured evidence, and without obstructing justice, trying to create the impression that something happened that you know didn't happen. So, for example, if a medical examiner has a calculation of the time of death in a murder case, and they say, well, the death occurred at 10 o'clock at night, and it turns out the death really did occur at 10 o'clock at night, you know that because your client killed the person at 10 o'clock and admitted it to you. But there's a mathematical error in the medical examiner's report. You have, as a lawyer, both the right and maybe even the obligation to challenge the veracity and legitimacy of that report by focusing on the mathematical error. And you can even put on your own expert witness to ridicule the medical, the autopsy report, and to suggest that you couldn't possibly convict somebody based on this kind of shoddy work. That's actually a bit controversial as to how far you can go with that, but it's not that controversial. And I have a quote from a legal ethicist here who says that a defendant who has been wrongly identified as the criminal but correctly identified by a nervous elderly woman who wears eyeglasses as having been only a block away 5 minutes before the crime took place If the woman is not cross-examined vigorously and her testimony shaken, it will serve to corroborate the erroneous evidence of guilt. Should the lawyer cast doubt on that elderly woman's identification to keep his innocent client out of prison? Well, the students all say, I guess you should. I mean, even if she was telling the truth, you don't want an innocent person going to prison. You don't even want a guilty person going to prison in this adversarial system. You have an obligation not to. And not everybody would want to do that. And the answer that the criminal lawyers have to those who don't want to do it is just do something else. There's lots of careers. So it's really a very aggressive stand with respect to the suspension of sincerity that our adversarial system has. Your system has less of that because the lawyers play much less of a role in the actual questioning in the system, from what I understand. And we can talk about where the differences lie and where the similarities lie. In civil litigation, though, if there's a trademark dispute here in Germany, there'll be a certain amount of lawyerly framing effects in which the lawyers will want to help their clients either prove that there was a trademark infringement or there wasn't. They won't lie, they won't obstruct justice, they won't play around with the evidence, but they'll do what they can to help their clients' cause. That's what they were hired to do. Now, there's something that's especially interesting when it comes to the suspension of the sincerity conditions, and that is that lawyers are trained to be insincere about being insincere. So all the trial practice books, we have courses called trial practice or trial advocacy, where you have these simulated trial experiences, and often we have judges teaching the courses, and the students play various roles in the system and are critiqued for how well they play them. They're taught how to play them and so on. And the books, all of the books tell the lawyers, you really have to look sincere. There's nothing worse than a lawyer who looks insincere. I'm going to say something that I'm embarrassed about. I hired, while I was associate dean, I'm sorry that you mentioned that I was, I hired an acting teacher who will work with students to understand how they project themselves better so that they can do this more effectively. She doesn't teach, eight students want to take this course in the winter for 4 days. But they do take it. There's a big waiting list, and they're interested in doing it. So if you can get people to let down their guard and not remember that you really have a job to do if you're the lawyer, by looking at and have the, whether it's a juror or a witness or a judge or anybody in the system, regard you as somebody who's speaking sincerely and from the heart, then you're a better lawyer. And it's not that everybody's going to let down their guard all the time, but they'll let it down sometimes because they can't help themselves for reasons that I'll get back to in a few minutes. That's actually, I think, a much more serious aspect of insincerity among lawyers than is the standard concern, which is representing people in whose cause you don't believe. I find it inevitable that if you're going to be a lawyer, it shouldn't matter that much, unless something offends you terribly, that you're stepping into the shoes of somebody who needs some help and giving them the help. What's much more difficult is how you do it. It's the decision to look sincere when you're not sincere. It's the decision to file a motion in court to try to gain an advantage that you might not really deserve, or to answer papers when the answer should be, well, I give up because you're right, and so on. Now, when I talk about insincerity, I'm talking not about lying, but about saying things without being personally committed to what you're saying. But it doesn't mean you're saying things that aren't true. The only lack of truth is in how you are presenting yourself. So, this is an important part of lawyering. This distinction is very important. Lawyers are simply not allowed to lie. They're not allowed to stand there and say that my client was in Germany when their client was really in Spain. You can't say that. And it's sanctionable conduct anywhere to stand there and lie. It's not sanctionable conduct, however, for lawyers to frame things in a way that would be helpful to their clients. So that distinction is really at the heart of the suspension of insincerity. So I think it's worth exploring the difference between lying on the one hand and deceiving by other means on the other. I think it's really a core concept. And it probably does more work than it has the right to do. First, in many contexts, lawyers and witnesses both are licensed to be shady, but not literally dishonest. Now, lawyers in the courtroom have it easy. They have it easy because their job is to ask questions. Questions don't have truth values, so you can't lie by asking a question. And it's not that unusual when a lawyer asks a question that's totally objectionable for the other lawyer to stand up and say, "I object to that question. That there's no evidence of that." And the lawyer says, "I don't have any evidence. I was just asking a question." Because you can't ask an untrue question. So in the article, I have this question: "Weren't you in Bermuda with your lover last April?" And maybe this person's never been to Bermuda. What you will do is you will attribute to the lawyer some level of humanity and good faith. You will assume that the lawyer wouldn't have asked such a question if there weren't a good reason for it. And there'll just be this innuendo sitting around the courtroom. There are restrictions on all of this. And the restrictions are that the lawyer has to have a good faith basis before they can ask a question. Nonetheless, there are ways to frame questions to create the impression that things happened that didn't happen and that things didn't happen that did happen. Even things like incredulity in the tone of voice. "Are you telling us that X?" when the witness was telling us that X, and that's because X really happened. But the incredulity in the lawyer's voice is used to create the impression that if you trust the lawyer more than you trust this particular witness, you should have your doubts about that witness. And of course, the lawyer wants you to trust the lawyer more than the witness through this insincerity about insincerity, to which we'll return in a little while. Now, as for witnesses telling the truth being allowed to lie or being able to speak deceptively short of lying, there's a Supreme Court case involving a bankruptcy, and they asked the guy, "Did you have any bank accounts in Swiss banks, Mr. Bronston?" "No, sir. Have you ever?" "The company had an account there for about 6 months in Zurich." "Well, that was true. It was also true that he had an account there for about 6 months in Zurich." But the lawyer asking the questions assumed, consistent with the kinds of implicatures that people make, the lawyer assumed that that meant that the guy didn't have an account in Zurich, and therefore he moved on and never found out about the account. When the prosecutors found out about it, they prosecuted this person for perjury, and the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 that that's not perjury because he didn't lie. He only misdirected the lawyer towards believing something to be true that the witness knew wasn't true. So that distinction between misdirection on the one hand and literal falsity on the other is something that lawyers are allowed to do, and it's something that witnesses are allowed to do. And I give the famous example of Bill Clinton when he was asked about whether his lawyer had been lying by saying that the president is not having a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky, and the prosecutors in his grand jury testimony, you know, were just berating him for not correcting it. "And didn't you know that your lawyer was lying?" He said, "Well, it depends upon what the meaning of the word is." And that had to have been on German television, wasn't it? I mean, it was, you know, it was that was the entertainment event of the year. And what people don't remember, though, is that the lawyer was playing all kinds of linguistic games to try to trick a witness into conceding something that wasn't true and to taking moral responsibility for the statements of others. And this was all a game where two sides were trying to avoid lying, but to try to create various kinds of impressions and get advantages. It was really quite an ugly scene. Now, one of the problems with lying versus deception is that the line isn't always clear. Not everybody draws the line in the same place. I've been drawing the line at literal truth versus misdirection, and I've meant it that way. But there's a wonderful linguistics paper from some time ago by Coleman and Kay, and they give this story. I'll read it to you. John and Mary have recently started going together. Valentino is Mary's ex-boyfriend. One evening, John asks Mary, "Have you seen Valentino this week?" Mary answers, "Valentino's been sick with mononucleosis for the past 2 weeks." "Valentino has in fact been sick with mononucleosis for the past 2 weeks, but it is also the case that Mary had a date with Valentino the night before." Did Mary lie? About a third of the people say, yeah, she lied. About two-thirds of the people say she didn't. And it's on a 1-7 scale. So one is that one would be, that's really a prototypical lie. And seven would be, no, that's a prototypical truthful statement. And there weren't too many ones and sevens. People are either in the middle or undecided. And when I do this with my students, they find it perplexing that anybody would disagree with them, and they get mad at each other. How many would think that this is some kind of lie, just in your own moral intuitions? Anybody? One looked at this is we have a television where you see the Congress voting, and once in a while somebody votes. So that's how many people would say that's one kind of a lie, even if it's not a terrific example of a lie. You would call that person a liar. And how many say no, that's not a lie? It's a bad person, but not a lie. So same kind of thing that they found in their experiment. But we find people on different sides of it, and if you get angry at each other, that's fine. Just remember who had their hands up, and you can talk about it later. So there's not even an accordance with it, and it's probably because when somebody is as dishonest as that, you hate to let her off the hook by not calling her a liar, even if you know that's not typically how you'd use the word lie. It's pretty bad stuff. And philosophers have the same kind of disagreement with each other, and they argue with each other about all of this. There's a whole literature in moral philosophy about whether lying and deception by misdirection are equally bad or lying is worse. There's a very good American philosopher, Jonathan Adler, who writes, "The desperate means to avoid lying while going easy on deception is not accidental. For if it is never right to cooperate with evil, and lying is a fundamental wrong, then only a strong distinction, where deception is not seriously bad at all, will help." So we try to distinguish liars from everybody else, and it may be at the expense of sometimes being too light on deceivers. That's the position that he's taking. The difference between lying and deception is that a liar directly leads the hearer to believing something to be true that the liar knows to be false because they actually said it. Whereas the deceiver leads the hearer to draw false inferences, thus arriving at the same place, but with more participation on the part of the target. And somehow, in our minds, we tend to think it's better to deceive than it is to lie. There's a very interesting English philosopher. She's working at Sheffield University, Jennifer Saul. She comes up with this story. There's an elderly woman who is near death, and you also know her son. One day you see her son, you're talking, and later that day you find out that the son was tragically killed in an automobile accident. couple of days later, you go and visit the mother, and she says, "Gee, have you seen my son recently? How is he?" And you have three choices. The first thing you can say is, "Your son is dead." Well, you know, there are Kantians around. The second, that you know, honesty is a virtue. The second thing you can say is, "I saw your son yesterday, and he was alive and well." And the third thing you can say is, "Your son is alive and well." Now, some people would just say one because, you know, it's just wrong to lie. We can deal, you know, we're going to put that to one side for a moment and talk about the difference between two and three. From the woman's perspective, there's no difference between two and three. She's going to believe that her son is alive and well. In fact, that's why you would say two rather than three. Was two the deceptive one or two the lie? Whichever I used as two and whichever one I used as three, most people would be more comfortable with themselves in their own hearts saying, "I saw your son yesterday and he is alive and well," than they would in saying, "Your son is alive and well." There's very good arguments, incidentally, that the first of these statements is morally worse, because if you lie and you know that lying is wrong, you've taken a moral position and you're saying to yourself, even though I've done something that's wrong, in principle, I think I can justify it now and I will live with the consequences of having lied. We were talking about that yesterday. Whereas the deceiver can feel virtuous by virtue of not being a liar, even though they their remark had the same effect, persuasive effect, on the elderly woman. So Jennifer Saul says that the difference between lying and deception that we sense is really a moral blind spot. Anybody who's been deceived in a way that seems unpleasant or just wrong is really no less angry and no less justifiably angry than the person who's been lied to. If somehow an automobile dealer convinces you to buy a car that's not in good shape, and they do it by lying, or they do it by saying things that will lead you to draw an inference that the car's in better shape than it really is, you won't say, "Well, this is entirely my own fault. This was an honest man. He never said anything that was literally false. I guess I'm stuck with it." You'll exercise whatever legal rights you have to bring that car back in either case, and you might not even notice the difference. If anything, you might be more angry that they went to the trouble of having this crazy story because so that they can try to get you to blame yourself. Most philosophers think that there really isn't much moral difference between a lie and a misdirection in terms of the recipient, but we still feel better. And it may well be that it's not so terrible to draw the line between lying and deception, because at least, number one, we have a rule, and number two, the deceiver at least seems to throw some kind of bone at the virtue of truthfulness, and it might make for a more truthful society generally. It's about as far as anybody can go. It's not much of a distinction morally, if that's all you can do. And if it's not much of a distinction morally, because that's all you can do, no wonder why lawyers in the United States have only an 18% approval rating for being honest people. Because what they latch onto for being honest, namely the distinction between misdirection and lying, isn't much of a distinction at all in the minds of most people, even though when it's up to you to act, you would rather be a deceiver than a liar. It's very complicated psychologically. In fact, as I was working on this paper, I went to some, I work in this semester in the psychology department at Princeton, so I talked to some of the psychologists. I said, "I'm working on this paper. Can you please direct me to the literature on the psychological differences between lying and deception?" And there isn't any. For some reason, nobody's really studied this, at least nobody that I know much about. So we've designed some studies, and the next paper I write will have to do with people reacting to the kinds of situations that we've been talking about here and seeing whether, you know, how idiosyncratic my views are and how much they reflect how people react in various kinds of experimental settings. Sorry. Now, why do lawyers get away with any of this stuff? I mean, if you're being asked a question by a lawyer and you know that they're not on your side, or you are the judge and you know the lawyer's trying to advocate for their client, or in our system, if you're on the jury, you can't possibly miss the fact that the lawyer is this, you know, person who has a job to do. Why would you ever let your guard down and be deceived at all? And the answer is a psychological one, which is that psychologists call correspondence bias. And there's a quotation here: when people observe behavior, they often conclude that the person that performed the behavior was predisposed to do so, that the person's behavior corresponds to the person's unique dispositions, and they draw such conclusions even when a logical analysis suggests that they should not. So we are biased towards attributing to people's behavior their character rather than their circumstances. So you are more likely to say that a lawyer looks sincere because he is sincere than you are to say that a lawyer looks sincere because he has a job to do and he's been well trained. Now, obviously, the second is true. The first may be true also. It's not that lawyers are all bad people. You don't go into an immorality booth the minute you pass your lawyer exams. But they're both going to be true to some extent, but we tend to associate people's behavior with their character. So the more the lawyer can look like a friendly person, the kind of person that's conversational — we're always taught to be conversational — and somebody who seems to be trustworthy, the more the lawyer can do that, the less the person is going to be thinking, I'd really better hold on to my wallet, because something bad's about to happen. Instead, the person's going to let down their guard. They don't let it down all the time, and not everybody lets it down at all. But some people will let it down, and some people will let their guard down more, and they'll be susceptible to this. I won't spend the time on it now, but in the paper are some descriptions of some very interesting experiments that show how it is that we tend to value explanations based on people's character above explanations based on circumstance. It's a robust phenomenon. It's studied widely under the names of either correspondence bias, or for those of you who study psychology, it is sometimes called the fundamental attribution error. I've never named anything the fundamental anything, but that's what it was called for a while, somewhat arrogantly. So it's not so hard to be successful at all of this. And then, getting back to these trial advocacy books, listen to this quote. They're taught, these teaching lawyers about how to make a closing statement in a jury trial after all the evidence is in and you're talking to the jury. Jurors are looking for conviction. Conviction meaning conviction to something, not that they want to convict somebody of a crime. They are looking to see which lawyer really believes his side should win, as contrasted with the lawyer who is merely making a closing argument because it's expected. Therefore, your most important concern is to present your closing argument in a way that demonstrates your total conviction in your case and your unwavering commitment to your side. If you know how to do that, you might win some more cases. That's insincerity training. And I have the acting teacher to make sure you're good at it. Once in a while, lawyers really can lie. And it's kind of interesting to see when. They can lie in setting up certain kinds of undercover operations. Now, the lawyers themselves typically don't engage in these. They hire detectives to do it. But it's as an ethical matter, we don't distinguish between situations in which the lawyer actually does something and situations in which the lawyer hires someone to do it for them. They're ethically the same as far as our ethical rules are concerned. And so the classic undercover operations, of course, are done by the police. prosecutors work with the police to set up situations where it looks like it would be an inviting situation for somebody to complete a crime, and then they're arrested for it. And for a while, those were really the only people who were allowed to do it. Then sometimes a defense lawyer would set up an operation like that. And there was one example I have in the paper where somebody accused of various sex crimes wanted to show that this child, this boy who had a computer, was actually downloading all kinds of pornography independent of his relationship with this particular a criminal defendant. But he couldn't get a hold of the computer. So he hired an investigator, and the investigator calls up the child's family and says, "Congratulations, you've won a new Hewlett-Packard computer. Just trade in your old one to us, and we'll be happy to give you a new one." So they did. They came to the door, they took the old one, and they were able to prove the pornography was on the computer. The lawyer was brought up on disciplinary charges for being unethical, for lying through this investigator about who he was. And the court said, you know, we have a real problem with trying to put the lawyer in prison. They wouldn't put the lawyer in prison, but trying to take disciplinary action against a lawyer who brought out the truth when the prosecutors wouldn't cooperate enough to get a hold of that computer that the defendant needed. So we're not going to do anything in this situation. And the classic situation has to do with what we call testers in civil rights cases. So it's not, unfortunately, it's not unheard of for a landlord to be willing to rent an apartment to a white person with certain financial credentials, but not rent that same apartment to a black person with the same financial credentials. It is perfectly legal for civil rights advocates to send testers who come in with virtually the same kinds of dossiers with respect to what they can afford and not afford and see whether there is racial prejudice. In fact, it's not easy to find out how else you're ever going to do it, because it's never going to be the case that just because the landlord rejected one tenant or a real estate agent rejected one potential buyer that you can prove that this was really because of race. But you can if you set it up as a controlled experiment with the corresponding white people being the control group. And that's really what they do. Perfectly legal. Generally speaking, it's legal for lawyers to lie about their identity in these kinds of situations where it actually seems to enhance the adversarial system and not duplicate proceedings that are available anyway to lawyers. So that's the exception when they can really lie. They could actually go there and lie themselves and be their own testers, but you really wouldn't ever do that, because if a lawyer is an important witness in a case, they then have to leave the case as the lawyer. You can either be a lawyer or you could be the witness, but you can't be both, which means you would give up your fee. So no lawyer is going to be the tester in a civil rights case. They're going to hire a tester, and then they're going to be able to make their legal fees while the tester is doing the testing. So the issue of having agents act on your behalf is really, as a practical matter, a non-issue. And it's just as well that the lawyers are held ethically responsible for what their agents do, but you're not going to find the lawyers doing it themselves. The situation is made somewhat worse by the fact that lawyers have their own jargon, and lawyers here in Germany have their own jargon too, as you know. The problem with the jargon is not that there is professional jargon. Of course there's going to be professional jargon. Engineers have it. Nobody gets mad at engineers for talking like engineers when they're talking with one another. People do get mad in the States, at least at doctors, for being inadequately communicative by using big words for about 1 second and then leaving the room. But they get mad at lawyers for the jargon, in part because the experiences that lawyers are involved in for their clients are often very personal and unpleasant experiences. So when the lawyers start talking about them in a vocabulary that's alienating to the individual. It feels that the lawyer has taken ownership of part of the individual's life by translating what happened into some kind of new language that's inaccessible to the individual, litigating it or resolving it then, and then coming back and retranslating it to tell the individual what their fate is. And that is a very, very powerless experience to have. So it raises the stakes in trust. It makes it harder for individuals to trust the lawyers. And of course, the lawyers are not always deserving of trust, for partly for the reasons that I've been telling you. Even when they're trusting their own client, that is, even when you trust your own lawyer, trusting the profession generally, who's taking very personal experiences and talking about it in very kinds of professional ways that have nothing to do with how you experience it, is an alienating and threatening experience. And I think that that really adds to this situation, even though I don't think there's anything at the least bit wrong with the jargon. We have a very aggressive kind of plain language movement, and it's fine for consumer contracts and so on. Nobody reads them anyway. It really doesn't make any difference. In fact, now that they're all in plain language, the courts used to say, well, who can understand this? We're going to let the consumer win. Now you can understand it, and the consumer loses. I don't think it's done anything for consumers to have these things in plain language. It's perfectly good to have the documents in plain language and so on. But a lot of legal discourse sounds like legal discourse the way any other professional discourse sounds that way. And you can't do anything about it, but it exacerbates the situation. Now, I'm going to finish briefly with a couple of points. My argument that lawyers have a suspension of the ordinary sincerity conditions is, I don't think it's really terribly controversial. I don't see anybody's really put it that way. But I don't get that much disagreement about it. One of the things that's interesting to look at is, are there species of lawyers for whom this isn't true? Because if there are, it would be interesting to see if the discourse about these other groups of lawyers is such that they're saying, well, you're not a real lawyer, so you have to be honest, unlike the rest of them. And there is such conversation, and I have a couple of examples of them. One of them has to do with government lawyers. There are very strict rules governing the behavior of prosecutors. Prosecutors really are not supposed to prosecute criminal cases in which they don't believe. They may sometimes go a little overboard when they do believe it because they think they're on the right side putting the bad guys away. And they sometimes are hypervigilant and they sometimes break the rules. But they're really just supposed to reject a case if they don't think the person is guilty, even if they could prove the case. Unlike the criminal defense lawyer, I quote a famous criminal lawyer saying that it is true that a trial is a search for the truth. I'm just not a member of the search party. Well, prosecutors are supposed to be a member of the search party. You should not be acting on behalf of the state in a context in which state power demands legitimacy if you don't believe it. And most prosecutors abide by that, at least to some extent. When I say at least to some extent, you can have a boss that says, I want this person prosecuted. And you say, well, I don't really believe in the case. And they say, well, I don't think you heard me. So things like that happen. But to the extent that prosecutors have discretion, there are so many cases brought to them, there's no particular reason not to prosecute the cases that you believe in. And I think they do. The more difficult situation with government lawyers, as you know from recent American history, has to do with government lawyers in policy positions. And that gets to the torture memos during the Bush administration. A lawyer for the Office of Legal Counsel in the executive branch wrote some memoranda justifying the use of what they call harsh interrogation techniques. Most people use a different word for it during the interrogation. in particular, individuals in Iraq and elsewhere around the world. And if you read the memos, they're really bad legal work. That is, they look like the work of a lawyer who's trying to find some possible justification for saying that this kind of torture is permitted under the law, with all kinds of, excuse the expression, tortured interpretations of statutes that deal with what physical pain involves. The question is the definition of severe pain, and they he uses all kinds of definitions from statutes that involve reimbursement for medical costs and so on, to try to create some kind of argument that maybe you can win one out of 60 times, if you're lucky, in court. If you're making that argument, it's not a sincere argument. It's an argument made if you believe your obligation is to come up with something that uses the same language and at least gives some kind of cover to a president who wants to do something that would otherwise be illegal. It probably doesn't even do that, but it comes closer. If your obligation is to be saying that this is the law because you believe it's the law, that there's nothing sincere about this at all. So there's no way of justifying that whatsoever. It's impossible. They're very, very flimsy arguments from a legal perspective. So the question, once again, we were talking about the liar at least having to take responsibility for being a liar. I mean, you can have a president who says, well, there are times where the law says X, and I'm going to break the law and I'm going to take the consequences for it in some kind of dire emergency, or I would never break the law. But when you have the lawyers in there trying to reduce the value of the rule of law, then you have an independent problem, and that seems to me what we had with respect to the torture memos. And with most ethicists, it's very difficult to find a legal ethicist in the United States that'll defend any of this. So the ethicists all say that if you're working for the government, you have a special obligation to be sincere so that you would force the president to decide that he's breaking the law, if he wants to break the law, or that he's telling people to break the law, and then they're going to have to face the legal consequences of breaking the law. But instead of that, there was a decision to try to create some kind of very slim legal cover and then hope that, Rupert Murdoch's news stations would make it so that enough people would believe it. And that's just unacceptable conduct from the perspective of most legal thinkers. You saw what happened in our elections, so, I don't know if I'm in a majority of the population, but I'm certainly expressing what I think are more or less universal views among legal ethicists. I've seen nothing to the contrary. So the argument, of course, is that you're not just a plain lawyer who has a right to make whatever arguments you can make that won't get you in trouble for being just off the wall. You have a higher obligation than that, although the regular lawyers have no higher obligation. The second group that I talk about are the law professors. The law professors sometimes write submissions to the courts in what we call amicus curiae, which means friend of the court, and they presumably write them as intellectuals, not as advocates. So if I were to submit a brief or to sign a brief that somebody else has submitted, which I might do sometimes, somebody will say, well, I drafted this brief. Would you put your name on it as well? If I put my name on it, it's because I would believe that those are the best arguments. And if I don't think so, I just wouldn't sign the brief. But I wouldn't sign it just because I believe in the cause, even if I don't believe in the arguments, because I believe I have an obligation to be sincere, because I'm not submitting the brief
as an advocate, I don't represent the parties, and there's often excellent lawyers at that level. I'm simply somebody who's saying the academic, as a member of the academic community with knowledge that might be able to help you, here's what I think. And if I don't think that, I really shouldn't say it. And there, I talk about some controversial cases about that. And again, it's that you're not a regular lawyer, therefore you must be sincere. That's the argument that you see in those debates, suggesting that if you are a regular lawyer, you need not be sincere. That's how deeply entrenched these values of insincerity are. Well, the conclusion that I have in this paper is that I don't think the lawyers are the bad guys, because, as I said, it is absolutely inevitable that lawyers are going to be insincere, because when you speak on behalf of somebody else, the chances that you're going to believe in everything that your client holds to be important is remote. Sometimes it'll happen, sometimes it won't. And if you do try to take cases in which you believe, then you're really going to be insincere a lot of the time, because you're going to feel justified in using the mechanisms of the legal system in ways that themselves are insincere, even if you believe the general cause to be virtuous. So I don't think that is really the where the action is. I think that's just being a lawyer. The real action has to do with where you're going to draw the lines in, number one, what you do during the case, and number two, regardless of what the legal rules are there lines that you just don't want to cross because, as a decent person, you just don't want to pass that line? And the other really has to do with this insincerity about insincerity. There's something about a system in which your law school will attract better students because you have an acting teacher, that where there seems to be something amiss. So the only villains that I have in this paper are the legal educators in the United States. And that's because none of this is taken seriously. There's a professional responsibility examination that everybody has to take that talk about all these rules. And the students do learn the rules, and they take them seriously, and they make sure that they aren't going to get in trouble when they're lawyers. And most of them are, decent people who went to law school and then become lawyers, and there's really nothing terribly controversial about that. But the school itself, the legal education itself, doesn't project an attitude of solemnity. And medical school does. When you go to medical school, you have license to do all kinds of things, touch people and cut people and stab people and, all this sexual what would be otherwise sexual contact and so on. And you know that as a doctor, that's all in the context of something of a privilege that would otherwise be bad conduct. And it's in the service of something that is deeply honorable all the time. You're in the healing business. It's a good business to be in, an honorable business. And the lawyering business is a good business to be in also. If your job is to help people to put their best foot forward in a world in which it's very important that they do so, but they can't do it without you, that is not a dishonorable thing to do. And if you're mostly doing it in the context of something in which you believe, that's even a nicer thing to do, whatever your personal political values are. But with that comes a big responsibility, because just as doctors have all these privileges to do things that would otherwise be illegal and terribly wrong, so do lawyers. They have the right and the obligation to be insincere. And it's just not taken seriously at all. It's taken as just a set of rules of the road that you just have to abide by without any moral responsibility. I'm telling you all of this not because, in case any of you want to either enroll in an American law school or become a law professor in an American law school, but it would be but these remarks are rather severe that I'm making, and it would be interesting just for yourselves to compare what goes on here with what goes on in the States, both with respect to the level of advocacy and zealousness, which of course drives a lot of this in the States on the one hand, and the level of solemnity with respect to moral obligations that you have towards yourselves and towards everybody else in society. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your talk. It, for me, it was a troubling talk because I never thought about the distinction between deceit and lying, because I think when we are confronted in the German system with deceit and lying in criminal court cases is almost always about the same. So I never thought about this distinction. And I think it's really hard to get an ethical hold on it. And I'm really looking forward to the discussion because you accepted to take questions for the paper, and I'd like to open the discussion and see what this meant to you.
Well, thank you very much for your talk. It was very interesting. I have a question in regard to the torture memos. I'm not sure whether this is a very good example for your topic and for your thesis, because I think it's not the question whether Mr. Yu, or I don't know how to pronounce it. Yes,
that is how you pronounce it, yeah.
Who prepared the memos was sincere or insincere, but I think the question is whether he acted in regard with the standards of a legal advocate. So, in my opinion, he acted like a doctor, and you are saying, I have the flu, and he's cutting off your leg. So, and this is unethical, per se. And then we don't have to discuss whether he is sincere or insincere. And therefore, I would like to ask you the question, if Mr. Yu would believe in his arguments and would believe that what he was saying was true and waterboarding is not torture, would you say he acted ethical, or would you say no, because he kind of violated all the rules? We have in legal reasoning, he acted unethical as well.
The problem that you're raising, you're probably right about it, incidentally, is that remember in the beginning I said that there are two levels of intention that you typically project. The first one is saying what you're saying, and the second one is projecting that you believe what you're saying and trying to accomplish whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish, such as a threat. Not only did you mean to say what you said, but you meant to threaten. And for lawyers, what the suspension that I'm talking about, the lawyer has to intend to say what they say, and the lawyer also has to intend it as a legitimate legal argument. They just don't have to mean it, and they don't have to believe that this is the right thing to do. So that's the suspension that I've been talking about. Now, when you get the reason you might be right is that the U memos don't even meet that standard. And that's really what you're saying. So the better example would be somebody who is in the legal office of legal counsel, is making legitimate arguments because that's what they think that their boss would want, but it makes them sick. Should you be doing that if you're a government lawyer and you just think that's the wrong thing to do because you're working on behalf of the people? So there is that sense in which it's wrong. Now, it's not so much a question as to whether he believed that waterboarding was torture or he didn't believe that waterboarding was torture. The issue is really whether he believed that it is a legitimate legal argument that are in that memo. No responsible lawyer could believe that to be a legitimate legal argument. So what I think what my paper is missing is that he wasn't even insincere. He wasn't even sincere at the base level that applies to all lawyers. You never get to the government issue that I've raised, which might make it irrelevant. So I guess I'm ultimately agreeing with your point. Now, what happens if he's sincere and really believes this? Well, then you really can't, then you would have no, if he really believed in the legal, if he really believed that the best legal advice you could give the President of the United States is the following involving, in which he cites, he doesn't cite any of the authority because it's, it would be harmful, and he gives these crazy statutory arguments. If you really believe them to be true, and the best arguments, because he's just a miserably bad lawyer, well, then he's a sincere lawyer. He's just a lousy lawyer. I'm not worried about that problem so much, because he's not. I mean, he's a very smart man. He can't possibly, that couldn't possibly have happened.
Two questions. The first one, I think judging the lawyer, you have to see the context. So probably you don't expect anything else from a defense lawyer than to be pro on the pro side of his defendant. Or from a government lawyer, I mean, why is he employed? Well, just to do everything to have the politics, the politicians have their way. So if you got you've been asking around who can justify my cause, and then you get a paper and that's it. Nobody expects anything else. I mean, if you have time to contemplate about why this paper has been published. The second one is you didn't speak about the judge as a lawyer in this context.
Just last week, I took that section out of the paper. Sabina was here. So somebody had asked me, you had asked me for the paper, and I said it'll be ready after this weekend. I spent the weekend taking that out. And it's a new paper I'm writing about judges. I worked on it today. The reason I took that out is it's entirely relevant in the sense that judges are not always sincere in why they gave the decisions, and in common law reasoning, judges have an obligation to give lengthy explanations of why they did what they did. So we have very good laboratory conditions, especially in the United States, less so in Britain, but also in Britain, and the And there are plenty of examples where the kinds of, I write about these language cases an awful lot. So there's, for example, there's a case where the the question was whether discrimination, we have anti-discrimination laws in employment. You do too, obviously. And there's a statute of limitations of 18 months. So this woman was hired and paid less than men. She found out about it 2-3 years later. She sues. She says, well, there's an 18-month statute of limitations, so I'm only allowed to collect for the past 18 months. The employer said, no, if you don't find out about it within 18 months, we can discriminate forever. And the case makes it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the 5 right-wing judges support the employer, and the 4, more liberal judges support the employee, and then eventually the first law passed after Obama became president was the law, was a change in that law, so to override what the court did. Now that's a, you know, now the argument that the majority made is that when you think of the word discriminate, the best understanding of that word would be whatever the act was where you decided to discriminate. If it turns out that you also then hired a payroll service that's just issuing these things, you're not discriminating. You already did discriminate. And the woman said, no, that's ridiculous. Every week when I get a check that's less than what the men made, I've been discriminated against. Well, you've been discriminated against because of our earlier act of discrimination, they say. It's not that we're discriminating against you now. We don't even remember who you are. So that was what the argument was. Now, how can you possibly say that there's sincerity going on there when the issue has to do with some linguistic preference with respect to word meaning? I mean, if that word indeed is subject to multiple interpretations, you know, including contextual ones, if it weren't politically loaded, why in the world would you expect your politics to associate with you a broad or narrow scope of certain kinds of verbal interpretation? It wouldn't. So there's a perfectly good example of the judges being insincere. The only reason I took it out is because in order to write about it, you have to write about it at a certain length. And you don't compare the insincerity of judges to the insincerity of lawyers as a baseline. So it wasn't fitting crisply into my argument. But it doesn't mean that what you've said is at all wrong. It's there, and it's there for the asking. And we have quite a significant literature on judicial candor, incidentally. If it's something that you're interested in pursuing, just send me a note and I'll give you some things to find. Now, in terms of the government law, your other question, your first question, that's the issue. The issue is, if you work as a lawyer in government, can the people you work for just expect you to say anything they want you to say? And the ethicist said no. I mean, John Yoo was referred for disciplinary action. He was going to be referred to more disciplinary action, but the Obama administration didn't want to look too contentious. So they softened it, but they recommended that the state refer him for that, for exactly that reason. And there are positions in government where people tend to think that they have some kind of a higher duty. And as I said, if President Bush wanted to torture people, even though it was illegal, and take the consequences, he probably could have. I mean, who's going to stop him? But for lawyers to give cover so that the rule of law also permits that is something that is that it's ethically it shouldn't be permitted.
As your criticism was principally directed at the legal educators, what would you say could be specifically done differently in legal education to improve that or to instill greater sensibility for these moral issues involved?
Well, first thing is that there should be, right in the beginning of legal education, it's a little different where it's an undergraduate program, incidentally. It's in the United States, as you know, you already have a university degree before you go to law school, and then it's a three-year professional program, 3 years full-time or 4 years part-time at some institutions. So I don't know how universal these solutions would be because, you know, we're not talking about you know, people who are 18 and want to study law, but they'll have different professional agendas and so on. It might be a little more difficult. At any rate, it should start from the first day. You come into law school and people talk about this stuff. That's number one. And number two, it should be integrated into all the classes. So as you're taking, we have contracts and torts, civil procedure and criminal law and evidence and all of these kinds of courses, most of which overlap with the subject matters here, the ethical issues should be introduced at all times so that the school itself is constantly projecting a seriousness about about the tension between everyday moral values on the one hand and the role of the advocate on the other, so that you never lose sight of being the decent person that you walked in the door being. That's what I think we should do. And I'm working now on a set of materials with another law professor that would be just that. That is, the first day of school, you come in, and there'll be some special program, and you read the first 10 pages of this thing. And then there'll be a section for all of the major courses that you would take all the way through law school. Not everybody takes each course because they specialize differently. But everybody takes all the first-year courses. That's mandatory. And then periodically, if you took corporations, there'll be some ethical issues with respect to being a corporate lawyer, and so on, so that there's constant reminding about this all the way through. And at least the educational system has projected onto the new members of a profession an attitude that's serious about being the good person you want to be.
Well, in Germany, at least as far as I know, in civil cases, but in criminal cases as well, the lawyers are not allowed to lie in court. But that seems to be totally different in the adversarial system. Lawyers are not even allowed to lie in certain situations. They're even obliged to do so, if I've got right what you're saying.
No, lawyers are never allowed to lie. That's why they go through all these schemes. You're not allowed to lie. You see, now we're back to Valentino and John and Mary as to what constitutes a lie, but they're not allowed to lie. They're allowed to frame things favorably.
Okay. So go that long.
Yeah. And in fact, the courts are quite serious about that. When a judge sees a lawyer lying, they get very, very angry. Mm-hmm. But they... They don't get too angry at witnesses who lie, but they get usually anyway. But they get very angry at lawyers who are liars. What they don't get angry at are lawyers who are creating misimpressions all the time, mm-hmm. without lying.
So if you're convinced that your client is guilty in a criminal case, you can't mislead the court.
You're supposed to. But by mislead the court, you don't miss. You know, there are certain ways that you're allowed to do it, and certain ways you're not allowed to do it. So, as I said, if the prosecution's witness is there, and you decide that the only effective thing you have now is to use an incredulous tone of voice, and asking questions, because if the jury or the judge, whoever's trying the case, trusts you, you wouldn't be speaking that way. Unless there was something bad happening, these kinds of things. Now, they might be lawyers' tricks that don't get you anywhere most of the time, but some of them do get you someplace. And, you know, it just depends on who's listening and how well it's working that time. So,
what does that mean for the objective, for the aim of procedure as a whole? Is it not to find the truth?
Well, yes. So there's a confidence that... that when in an adversarial system, when you have people beating each other up for long enough, somehow the truth's going to come out. And so, you know, maybe it won't. Maybe it will. But this is certainly, this is not good news. This my perspective on all of this would suggest that if you really believe that the truth is coming out, you'd better show it. Now, lots of times the truth comes out because the evidence is clear enough anyway. I don't really want to give a terrible impression. Lots of times somebody's arrested at the ATM machine because it's filmed. They see the guy. They're not wearing a mask. You can see who it is, and they go and arrest him. And it really is that guy, and he really pleads guilty, and he really did it, and he's punished. So there's a lot of things that work, you know, fairly well. It just has to do when you have these cases where the evidence is not maximally strong and different kinds of framing effects and various levels of insincerity might be able to help in one direction or another. That's kind of how it works. So it's a little bit better than your first question would have suggested, but it's not great.
Short follow-up on this question. Is it all about the rules of the game? Of the game of having this adversarial trial where you at least, it seems to be asymmetrical, at least in some cases, because prosecutors are not allowed to deceit, to be dishonest and insincere. So couldn't it be an idea, and wouldn't this idea explain a bit of the discrepancy between our everyday notion of the difference of deceit and lying, which isn't too strong, and the strong implication it has for lawyers in trials, that you would say, okay, if you give the lawyers this means of framing things, because we think that we are only justified to put people in prison if we have really strong evidence that can even overcome framing like this, and this keeps us from putting people in prison too easily. And couldn't you imagine rules of the game where you would say, okay, lawyers get one lie free, and the one lie free rule. And you only trust your system if your evidence is so strong that it can overcome at least one lie. And it would just be, and then lying would be fine. Is it that? Is that the reason why we treat deceit differently in this special circumstances of the court situation? And we could even imagine a system where we would treat lies differently. And in some ways we do. You mentioned the cover-up things, the undercover operations. There we think, yeah, okay, that's we can employ lies because we think that's a way we come closer to the truth.
Every criminal lawyer believes what you just said. That is, in the United States, you know, most people committed who are accused of crimes actually committed the crimes they're accused of. I don't think there's a lot of doubt about that. Some people aren't, and there are innocent people in prison. But it's not for every 100 people in prison, you know, nobody did anything. So there's just an error rate. So and criminal lawyers, defense lawyers, articulate what they're doing exactly the way you stated. They're saying that in a decent society, the government cannot exercise that level of power over people to lock them up and to take away all their rights and freedom, and these, you know, prisons are terrible places, unless the government has proved its case with the enormous enormous imbalance of evidence in favor of conviction. And my job is to put as many roadblocks as the system allows in the way of the prosecutor, and if the prosecution can survive that, then it's okay to take away the freedom. And of course, in the area of legal interpretation, where you and I both work, we find the same thing with the rule that says that criminal statutes are to be interpreted narrowly when there's an ambiguity. We have that rule, and so does so do you. And the reason for that, again, is unless you know that the legislature, with some high level of certainty, criminalized conduct, we're not going to put them away for that either, and the judges are supposed to be sensitive to those ambiguities. Now, as far as the prosecutors are concerned, I think I said not quite enough about it. The prosecutors are not supposed to prosecute cases they don't think are meritorious cases. But once they do it, the gloves are off. They can do anything they want, and they do. They play very aggressively, and they're at least as aggressive advocates as anybody else. And they feel that the that all the cards are against them because the defense, they have to turn a lot of things over to the defense, but the defense doesn't have to turn anything over to them, and so on. So they then feel, the prosecutors feel like they're on the right side, they're on the side of society, they're on the side of safety, they're on the side of right in a world of right and wrong, and they're also playing in a handball court where there are six people slapping handballs all over the court while they're just trying to hit the right one. And they feel oppressed and that there's some license to even be more aggressive because of that. That's kind of the mentality of the prosecutor in that situation. So they're not really timid. They just are discreet in the first instance as to what cases they're going to bring, and then it's they're just like any other advocate, as far as I've seen. They cross-examine aggressively too. And now, can you have a one free lie rule? I don't know. You made that up just now, and I don't know what you're
based on an idea of a, say, battle of arguments that relies heavily on some kind of idea of an ideal discourse, to use expression by Habermas. And isn't one of the fundamental prerequisites of such an ideal discourse that actors in this discourse are sincere? So isn't, at least on a purely theoretical level, and perhaps leave criminal law out of the picture just for the moment, isn't on a purely theoretical level sincerity really really a prerequisite? And isn't it only for pragmatical reasons and some kind of compromise that we allow some sort of insincerity, because in most cases we can't really prove that someone is insincere? How would you? And so we couldn't really stop people from being insincere in court.
I think it's a little worse than that. And the reason is that I don't see how you can have a sincere discourse in a situation where you're not obliged to really always be expressing your views, but you're obliged to express positions that somebody would express if they could, but they can't because they don't know how. It's really what your job is. So you can decide, take some, let's say that you're representing a polluter, and the question is whether the amount of polluting material coming out of their factory meets current standards under German law. And if you look at it one way, it does. It does meet the standards. If you look at it a different way, it doesn't. That is, perhaps if you measure it based on the amount of particles per hour, it looks pretty bad. But it looks pretty good, but if you look at it in a different way, it looks pretty bad. Now, so the question would be, would you represent that client and say to the court that, or the administrative agency, that, we're looking at it this way, and that's really the better way to look at it, because if you look at the following other situations that seem like this, the analogies seem to support this view of things, when you'd rather that you'd rather that the place gets shut down and that they have to fix their emission standards. Well, you have to decide whether you're going to take that case or you're not going to take that case, and that's a moral dilemma. But once you take the case, if there's a legitimate argument there, I mean, I don't know what you're going to do. I mean, if you, your job is to help that client present a position that that they don't know how to present because they don't know how legal proceedings work. So what are you going to do?
Well, doesn't that might be a little provocative from the German point of view?
I try.
Doesn't that call no me being provocative?
Oh.
doesn't that call the whole adversarial system in question?
Sure.
If you say sincerity isn't even possible in a situation where you represent someone, and then for me the whole notion of an adversarial system where we trust in this discourse to come to the truth eventually by beating up each other, as you say, doesn't that just erase the whole base of this system?
I wouldn't say it erases the whole base of the system, but it certainly draws into question, you know, what it is that you're doing. I mean, I find less of a problem as if it's clear what it is that polluter would be saying, and it's a legitimate thing to say. You could decide that you're not going to represent the polluter, and then somebody else will represent the polluter, if you don't feel good about yourself. But whatever it is, it's pretty clear what that polluter is going to say to justify itself. The worse issues, and I really agree with you at this level, have to do with the decisions internal. That once you're in the system and you're in the case, are there times where we have a procedure called summary judgment, which is sometime during the case but before a trial, if it appears that there's nothing in controversy, you can say, as a matter of law, we're going to win, and the court can give you an earlier decision based on the law. Once you prove there are no facts in dispute, maybe I'm sure you have some kind of truncated procedures here as well. And so let's say that the opposing party moves for summary judgment, and you're desperately trying to find some facts that you need a trial for, but you know perfectly well that you shouldn't. But you find something, you make up some concocted story. The judge really doesn't know enough about the case to be comfortable granting summary judgment, so they don't grant summary judgment, and as a result of the other party losing their summary judgment motion, you get a much better settlement before trial than you would have otherwise. That's actually a very standard situation. That's pretty bad, actually. Because you never thought you shouldn't, you never thought that you should be absolved from summary judgment in the first place, because you know perfectly well what happened. But you're trying to throw some kind of a smoke screen in order to deceive. You say nothing dishonest. There's nothing lying. There's not a single untruthful statement you made. But you've caused a diversion. Now you're saying, you know, are there serious problems with that? Of course there are. It's terrible. So that and those are the places, incidentally, where the legal systems have to make decisions about what to allow and how much insincerity and so on. It's not the first question about whether you should be representing somebody who has a problem. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It has to do if it offends you or it's just evil or whatever, you know, you can deal with these things, you know, on an individual basis. It has to do with, once you're in the case, what's that discourse going to look like? And it's not the fact that you're speaking on behalf of somebody else, so you can't have sincerity in the first place. That's true, but I find it not that interesting. It's what happens when you're in the case and you're making these decisions to try to direct the discourse in one direction or another, which if you were talking to your family, you would never talk that way because you would care about their trust and honesty. That's really where the problems arise. And the system itself has to balance those things, and it balances it however it does, and to the extent that it doesn't balance it enough in one direction or the other, it's subject to the criticisms that you've just given. There's no question about that.
Well, I'm wondering whether it would be useful to introduce a distinction between the ordinary lawyer's behavior in court when talking to the jury and a legal expert giving a legal argumentation in a brief, because to my mind, there is a distinction between a factual statement, which can be true or not true, false, and legal arguments, which can be strong or weak, but not truthful or untruthful. And maybe this is a cause of your trying to apply the word sincere or insincere to legal argumentation. But in your system, as I understand it, you always have to address the jury in the adversarial system, or mostly, and therefore you have to translate legal arguments into ordinary language. And maybe this distinction between, which we have in Germany, between legal discourse and the factual discourse puts the lawyers into the danger of being perceived as being insincere.
I'm sure it does. I mean, I think you have to be right about that. And it also may be, incidentally, you're very polite, but it may be that I'm trying to do too much with the same arguments. There are different contexts in which lawyers will be sincere or insincere in different ways. And I think I lied over that, actually. So, for example, getting back to the torture memos, those are arguments, those are illegitimate arguments about the state of law with respect to our anti-torture statute. And that's really quite different from a vigorous cross-examination of a medical examiner who had a mathematical error. They're both insincere in their own ways, but they're not insincere in the same way. I have no problem with the general remarks I'm making being contextualized and coming out differently in different situations. I just assume it will, and I just don't discuss it. Although I certainly should say that to give comfort there. And it may be that it's really not the same thing in ways that matters with respect to my general argument.
Well, if we're thinking about insincerity before the court, but isn't there also a fundamental question about lawyers being insincere in the relationship between the lawyer and the client? You've been speaking about lawyers putting the ideas of the clients into legal language or representing them, but are lawyers also often instilling ideas within their clients or pushing them to pursue certain legal ways or legal pressing charges or bringing forward arguments the clients otherwise would not have brought forward by themselves, or finding new ways of increasing damages? And isn't that also a fundamental problem, not insincerity before the court, but also insincerity between client and lawyer, and therefore the lawyer being more than just a representative, but changing the one who's being represented?
And it works in both directions, incidentally, with respect to lawyers and their clients. First of all, other polls in which they ask people whether they trust their own lawyers, they often do. They just hate all the other lawyers. And the lawyers who get disciplined in the United States are most often lawyers who stopped answering their clients' telephone calls and were irresponsible to them and really lost the trust of their clients. And it's the clients that bring the complaints against the lawyer for not being trustworthy advocates for them. they feel terribly betrayed, and they turn in their lawyers, I think, you know, often enough appropriately. There are cases where the lawyers push the clients into a level of discord with whoever the person they're not getting along with.